My name is Adam Levine.
Yo, this your man, Kirk Franklin.
Hello, everyone. I'm Erica Campbell.
From London, England and Washington, D.C., you are tuned in to Conversations with Allison J. The Journey to Here, brought to you by Ethel May Books. This is Conversations with Allison J. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Conversations with Allison J., The Journey to Here. Today, as always, we have another captivating and thought-provoking topic and guest. Here's your host, Allison J.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Conversations with Allison J., The Journey to Here. I'm Allison J. Please remember to subscribe to the channel, like the videos, and share. Today, we will be speaking with Dr. Laurent McCullough about the study Voices of Black Women, a groundbreaking study launched in May of 2024, led by the American Cancer Society. The study's aim is to figure out the underlying causes behind the disproportionate numbers of Black women who die from cancer-related illnesses. The Voices of Black Women study's focus is to better understand cancer and other health conditions among Black women, to drive a deeper understanding of cancer disparities, the largest study ever to focus on cancer risks and outcomes for Black women in America. Until this study, Black women have been woefully underrepresented when it comes to medical research. In fact, the vast majority of biomedical research was conducted exclusively on white men until laws and regulations were passed requiring the inclusion of women and minorities in clinical studies funded by public monies, like those from the National Institutes of Health. It is also documented that until the 1990s, most approved devices, medications and vaccines were exclusively being tested on heterosexual, non-disabled, seemingly healthy white men. Dr. McCullough is the co-principal investigator for Voices of Black Women. Her role at the American Cancer Society is to contribute to the growth and diversity of their supporters and lead scientific efforts in breast cancer, social epidemiology, and outcomes research. Her primary research interests are in cancer disparities and cancer outcomes. Her research goals are to improve cancer prognosis in marginalized populations using a multi-level approach to identify targets for pharmacological, behavioral, and policy intervention. It is important to mention that Voices of Black Women is not a clinical trial, but has a goal of enrolling over 100,000 Black women to participate in research. The groundbreaking Voices of Black Women study will focus on lived experiences to improve outcomes for the next generation. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us here on Conversations with Allison J, The Journey to Here. And I must admit, when I read the article in the magazine talking about this, I had to immediately do some research and reach out because I've done a previous podcast on Black maternal mortality rates. So you hope that the mistreatment and the disparities in treatment are isolated, but then you get to learn that they're really not.
Yes.
So, which is quite disheartening, but unfortunately is a sad reality. And what I wanted to also ask you, before we even go into your work and thought, why this line of work? What was it about this line of work and cancer research that drew you to this line of work?
Yeah. So I've always been interested in health, you know, even as a young child, you know, thinking I wanted to be a medical doctor. And so health has always intrigued me. When I was a sophomore in college, my father was diagnosed with cancer, and just helping and watching him navigate the health system, especially in an oncology setting, was really eye-opening to me. He ultimately succumbed to his cancer about 6 months after he was diagnosed. And I remember sitting in, I was pre-med at the time. I remember sitting in classes and you're talking about the biology and the physics and the chemistry. And I was like, well, what about all these other things? What about like the access? What about the neighborhood drivers? Like, what about all of these things that are more social or not necessarily biologic, right? Because when you think about it biologic, then it feels like it's something wrong with the person rather than thinking about like the systems which people have to navigate to have optimal health. And so that was when I decided to sort of move into public health. And obviously because of the connection with cancer, I became a cancer epidemiologist.
Well, firstly, I'm so sorry to hear about the passing of your father. It can't be easy to watch a loved one suffer and struggle with ill health and then, as you mentioned, eventually succumb to it. And when you mention about the biology of things and looking at the person itself, when I read the article, it says, why are so many Black women in particular, dying from cancer? And from your work so far and what we know, that because we know it's still in the very early stages, what have you learned as to why this is? Because you can imagine, as a Black woman myself, and I'm looking at this, it's staggering as to why so many of us are dying from cancer.
Yeah. So we like to say that it's multifactorial, meaning it's not just like one thing that is happening or that Black women are exposed to, but really over many different things. And we say also many different levels. So there is that biology, which is obviously very important for cancer, but then there are also things about neighborhood environments that drive cancer. And then there are things about our systems and our policies that determine whether or not someone would have a good outcome versus a bad outcome. And so multifactorial and multi-level. So I think over the past couple of decades, there's been a huge emphasis on healthcare access, which you know is important for all health outcomes. You know, having insurance, having transportation, being able to get to where you need to get, those things are very important. But in some of our early work, what my team has been able to sort of show is that even for Black women that have access, so they have insurance, they live in a higher socioeconomic neighborhood, they have among the worst disparities. And so what we often see is that for our white counterparts, as they move up in terms of SES and access, they have better health outcomes. For Black women, you don't see that nice progression. And so it's a term called diminishing returns, that even as we progress in terms of income and insurance and you know, our neighborhoods, we don't experience the same benefits. And so this was really intriguing to me because we can't just say, get a better education, get better insurance. There are other things that are driving it. You know, there is systemic racism in the medical care system. There are dependencies that Black women may have to contend with that their white counterparts don't necessarily have to. When we think about access, we typically think about, well, in your adult time, do you have access to these things without considering the generational aspect? So, you know, maybe you had poor health as a child. Maybe your childhood experience exposed you to certain things that helped your cancer initiate and then progress. And so it's really taking a step back and thinking about a woman's sort of total experience to why we're seeing the disparities that we do.
This is so alarming because, to your point, you would really think that the higher up the socioeconomic ladder you go, you have accessibility to better healthcare. But when I did that previous podcasts about the mortality rates for Black women, the woman that I spoke to, her name is Wanda, it was her daughter that passed. Her daughter had 2 degrees and worked for the CDC.
So
you look at it just like, okay, so it's quite easy to say, as you said, get a better education so that you can get better healthcare and so on and so forth. But for Black people, we're finding that's not even remotely true, is it?
Yeah. So, you know, having all those things, having good insurance, having access is helpful, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not helpful for us to the extent that it may be helpful for our white counterparts. And, you know, we hypothesize that that is because, you know, I always tell people, I'm a professor, you know, I have the most advanced degree you can have. But when I walk into a hospital, when I walk into a doctor's office, I am just a black face. Right. And it is not until I start disclosing my education and my knowledge that oftentimes I'm treated very differently. And sometimes I don't disclose on purpose just to see how I will be treated. And so even though you may have all of these things, it doesn't, you know, release you from some of the biases. When we talk about monetary access and monetary gains, oftentimes I try and tell people an $80,000 salary for a white woman is not the same as an $80,000 salary for a black woman. A black woman that is supporting her parents because there's not generational wealth, that's supporting her extended family and fictive kin because that's what we do in our communities, right? An $80,000 salary that doesn't give us access to that better neighborhood because of contemporary redlining. And so we have to think beyond those things that I think are immediately in front of us and start thinking about, again, the total systems that impact the total person.
It's something you said brought back something. I heard a comedian say once many years ago, he's well known at the top of his game, a black comedian, and he says, on what I make, my neighbors are dentists. What my counterpart makes, their neighbors are other A-list celebrities in Hollywood. So to your point, you've just reminded me of that, and it's quite shocking and alarming that still in 2024 we're having these types of conversations. Because in doing the research to talk to you today, I was looking into some of the statistics, and it mentions from the US Department of Health and Human Services offices on minority health, Black and African Americans have the highest mortality rate of any racial and ethnic group for all cancers combined. And for the most major cancers, as well, that's what it states, that the disparity is also when breaking this down along gender lines. And just one more of the statistics I was looking at in addition to the above, is like Black women have the highest death rate and shortest survival of any racial ethnic group in the US for most cancers. Black women are diagnosed at a 4% lower rate than white women with breast cancer, for example. Yet Black women are dying from the disease at a 40% higher rate than white women. That is enough to bring, that brought, it just brought tears to my eyes and got me emotional. When you, that disparities, that gap is alarming.
Yeah, it's very alarming. And the way that particular statistic is written is actually it is makes it seem better than it really is. Because when they're
Interesting.
looking at the mortality rate, they're looking at the mortality rate across the entire population. If you look at women who are diagnosed with cancer, so Black women diagnosed with cancer and white women diagnosed with cancer, a Black woman diagnosed with cancer is twice as likely to die. So it's twofold rather than 40%. So yeah, the statistics can be alarming. But that one in particular is one that I know well and study. And that's one of the things that I think is important. You know, I obviously live this work every single day, but when we go out and we start sharing, just so many Black women are like, I just had no idea. You know, I had no idea that the statistics were that bad. I had no idea 40,000 women died of breast cancer in this country every year, disproportionately Black women. You know, 260,000 women are diagnosed with breast cancer in this country every year. Black women are more likely, twice as likely than any other race or ethnic group, to be diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer, which is one that we don't typically have targeted treatments for. Is the one that Black women typically get. And so just, you know, the awareness around health and cancer, I think, is one of the nice things about this study. You know, even for women that may choose not to enroll or are not eligible, just bringing that awareness is important.
Yes, and it's It's breathtaking, though, isn't it? When you hear that, as you mentioned, it's twofold. So the statistics are actually worse than what is written. And to be honest with you, are we surprised that it's really worse than what's written? Because when we're looking at statistics, they always try to find the ways to put the paint the best possible picture anyway.
It's thinking about the general population that's reading the statistics. So if you're a Black woman and you don't have cancer, then you're thinking about, well, what's the odds of me getting cancer and then dying from cancer? But like most people aren't reading those statistics not having cancer, right? So I think it's better to compare women who've been diagnosed. Once you've been diagnosed, who lives, who dies, right? To me, that's a more relevant statistic to share. So it just depends on like who's in the denominator and what they're trying to communicate about the statistics. But either way, Black women are disproportionately affected.
And online, in line with say, the disproportionate rate that Black women are affected, with the statistics that have been mentioned, the more I read, the more I learned was some of the things as, it was a little shocking, but sadly not really surprising that until this study, Black women have been woefully underrepresented when it comes to medical research. So it's not just the diagnosis, it's also the research of Black, the medical studies that Black women are being part of. So the majority of biomedical research was carried out solely on white men, is what I learned, until laws and regulations were passed requiring the inclusion of women and minorities in clinical studies and any clinical studies that are funded by public money. And it wasn't until the 1990s that most approved devices, medications, vaccines, they were exclusively being tested on heterosexual, non-disabled, seemingly healthy white men. Now, I found that again shocking, but sadly, I wasn't surprised. And if we look at the history and certain medical studies, if we look at, for example, Henrietta Lacks, if we look at Tuskegee and others, would you say that there's possibly a fear of Black people participating in these studies? Or can we just look at it to say, you know something, this is actually just what it was? And I think what I'm trying to say also is because of what had happened, could it possibly have been, and I'm just playing a little devil's advocate here, that because of what has happened, they're like, okay, we're not going to touch Black people because of the history. And so we're just targeting white men? Or is it just as it's always been, women and of color, people of color, women are just totally always just being overlooked?
It may be a combination of both. I do think there was this term hard to reach populations, and Black people were a part of that. And I have a colleague here who always corrects us, and she says hardly reached, like they hardly reach out to us.
Oh, yes.
Which I really love that term a lot. It's a combination of things. There have been lots of medical atrocities in the Black community. But also, I think in more contemporary times where there have been substantial medical advancements, Black people generally have not been included. And this is in part by design. When you're thinking about the development of a new drug and these pharmaceutical companies make millions, if not billions of dollars, they want to make sure that their drug performs at its best. And so when you go to roll out that clinical trial, you are asking for people that are not obese. You're asking for people that don't have heart disease or diabetes or any of these other conditions, which we know minorities disproportionately have for a number of reasons that are beyond their control. And so we're not included in those studies. And so then you have a drug that's been developed on a very narrow population of people, and you don't know if it's efficacious in this minority population because they weren't a part of the testing of it. So all of those things, I think, collectively have driven the lack of medical advancement in this particular demographic.
Yes, and I'm just something that you're saying that just brought to mind as well, because we're hearing in the news recently about kidney diagnosis and the way that Black people have been misdiagnosed because of the testings were primarily done on heterosexual white men. And so you've just reminded me of that as well, in because I didn't even think of that when in doing the research. And I'm glad that you mentioned that hard to reach, because again, I'd never even heard of that, never even thought about it. And when you're looking at it, that Black women are absent, because the general consensus, right, it was that the Black women were absent from health research because they were deemed hard to reach. But when you look at it, thinking, okay, myself as a Black woman, what, I don't recall there being anything that I could even think about to say that I've been reached out to for research on anything,
right?
Absolutely anything. So with that being said, where are they finding all of these white men that they were testing on? How were they finding them? And why could it not be, why could the same thing not be done for other ethnicities?
Yeah, you know, oftentimes it's through their medical care providers that offer them opportunities to enroll in trials around drug development and drug efficacy. And number one, we know that Black people often aren't given that attention when they are under the care of medical professionals. I think there was a study that even showed like the average amount of time spent with patients varies by both gender and race. And so they're just not being offered these opportunities. Now, then you have to ask, well, is this a provider's bias? I'm just not going to offer this opportunity to you. Is it out of fear of rejection? Like, you know, I don't want to have to talk about Tuskegee. I don't want to have to talk about Henrietta Lack. So I'm just not even going to bring this research opportunity up. Mm-hmm. You know, like there could be a number of reasons that a provider decides not to share that opportunity with a particular patient. You know, and then our the way we access and utilize healthcare can be different than our majority counterparts. And so that may also play a role. So there are a number of different reasons why, you know, Black men have opportunities that, you know, Black people, Black men and women don't. But I think if we are trying to optimize health for everyone, then there should be some protocols, some policies, some procedures in place to ensure that there is equitable access for these types of initiatives and trials.
Yes, and you're talking about time spent with patients. And I remember watching on a social media platform that a doctor was fired from his position a few months ago because he was actually speaking out about the care that a Black mother in labor was given and how dismissive and flippant the lead doctor was, who happened to be a white man. And it turns out that the Black doctor was right.
Yeah.
Took her into surgery, she was bleeding, and he was so upset that he took to social media and was fired. I believe as a result of it, because the way that he's gone on tens of interviews, offers made and then they've been rescinded, that leads me to believe that there really is something to the biases as to how we are treated when we're sat in front of a doctor. Because again, going into my doctor's when I have an appointment, again, I don't recall studies being offered to me, discussed with me, even if it's something as simple as you've got high cholesterol, they've got this study. So to your point, when you look at it and from what you've learned in your research, has that really been a case of the time spent with patients really is different and shorter, and the treatment Black patients receive from their doctors has it being something that you all have noticed in your studies and research that is really a problem?
Yeah, so we haven't been able to sort of deeply look at time spent or to really look at provider biases and perceptions. What we have been able to do is look at a proxy of that, which are delays. So we've been able to look at delays from a woman first going in for a mammogram, then something coming back and them saying, oh, there's something suspicious. You need to come back, right? And then seeing that suspicious thing and then saying, hey, we need to do a biopsy. And one of our studies showed that of all the different barriers, so race, insurance, distance to facility, neighborhood, SES, being Black was the only driver of those delays, right? Didn't matter how far they had to drive. It didn't matter if they had insurance, just being Black. I think, and I might not get this exactly right, but I think for white women, the delay was about 26 days. For Black women, it was 42 days. And in something like cancer, every day matters, right? Mm-hmm. We've also seen delays in terms of surgical receipt. So Black women are more likely to have delays in getting that first line therapy, which is surgery. And that didn't matter what kind of facility they were seeing at. It could have been a nonprofit. It could have been an academic center. It could have been an accredited center. Just across the board, Black women were twice as likely to experience a delay. So that's how we've seen this manifest in our data, just looking at how long does it take for you to get to the next step in your course of diagnosis and treatment. And almost always the biggest driver is race.
Wow, that's, you've just made me think of my own experience. So last year, just during my routine mammogram and ultrasound, they're like, oh, there's a cyst. I'm like, but if it's not bothering you, leave it. So I'm like, oh, okay. Then I felt it had gotten larger. So I went back and they're like, yeah, it's a cyst, but just take vitamin E. It should go away. Like, oh, okay. And I did that. And then fast forward a couple of months, it got, the lump got so big, you could actually look at me and see it. It was that big. And the way that everybody's just dismissing it as a cyst, but this thing's getting bigger and bigger and painful as well in the bargain. And I just like, the mammogram was May. I had the follow-up diagnostic in December, and it wasn't until April of this year that they did the aspiration. And then when they did the aspiration, and for anybody that doesn't know what the aspiration is, they literally stuck a needle in and drew the fluid out. Yeah. Then they looked at it and like, oh, I think we may need to send this off for testing because it doesn't look right. And in my mind, I'm thinking, this is nearly a year. This is nearly a year.
Right.
And fortunately, thank God, it came back, not cancerous or anything like that. And they drained it and everything is fine. But God forbid, if it was something different, waiting this long. And I'm thinking, and now that we're having this conversation, is this really typical of what Black women face? Because it's not just the physical pain and discomfort I was in. Can you imagine mentally what it was doing to me? Like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, this thing is getting bigger, it's getting bigger. What is going on? What is this? They're saying this is a cyst, but what is this?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's absolutely true. And I can give you two quick examples. I don't know if you heard that way.
Sorry, you froze just for a moment. As if you don't know if I've heard of.
Yeah. So an influencer, Jessica Petway, I think she was a beauty influencer, had problems.
Yeah.
They went, fibroids. Then all of a sudden it's stage 3 cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Cervical cancer, and I have a woman that I work with in our group who at 28 years old had a lump and went to the doctor immediately because her mom had just been diagnosed with breast cancer. And they were like, oh, it's not anything. It's fine. 3 months later, she tried to go to the ER, like, just give me an ultrasound. Give me something. No, it's fine. Kept going. No, it's fine. 18 months later, her nipples are bleeding. She has a palpable lump and she has lymph node involvement. And she's diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer at 29 years old.
Wow. That's...
And it's, they say Black women, you have to take control of your health. But I respond to that by saying there are a lot of Black women who do.
Right?
And where are the providers? Where are the people that are listening, right? I think Black women are overlooked and oftentimes ignored. Our pain is ignored. And by the time you get someone who is willing to listen, oftentimes it's too late. And those are the pieces that I don't think we talk about.
And I'm glad you said that because that is why I wanted to have this conversation. Because my slogan is the more we have these conversations, the more these conversations can be had. And you're talking about these two instances, and you just reminded me because what led to me having the aspiration after having that second mammogram and ultrasound, having that diagnostic, and just being told to take vitamin E. Nothing else, just told to take vitamin E. I actually went to the ER because I was in so much pain. And can you imagine you just looking at somebody and you can see this lump? And I went to the ER. And when I left the ER and then I went to have the aspiration, they says, so did at the ER, did they give you any antibiotics, did any pain relief? And that made me think, actually, they gave me nothing. I didn't think of it at the time. So I, they're like, and so they visit, so they gave you no antibiotics, considering this is a cyst that is inflamed. They're like, no, I no, that no, they sent me on my merry way. Once they determined from after being in the ER, they did the ultrasound and determined that yes, it is a cyst, it's just that the cyst is inflamed as to why it's so large. But an inflamed cyst, and they gave me no antibiotics again. Just sent me home.
It is.
You've just actually, I completely didn't even think about that until you've just mentioned this, the case of this young lady, 28, 29-year-old young lady. And it's really, it can be quite disheartening for us as Black women. But the good thing is, there are studies such as what you're doing here, Voices of Black Women being run through the American Cancer Society. Now, this first of its kind, truly groundbreaking study, can you please go into us what this study actually entails? Because with the history of how Black people have been treated to the past when it comes to medical research, I think one thing that's important to mention that this is not a clinical trial, this particular study. But so can you please tell us more about it?
So you're right. It's not a trial, which means we're not testing a drug, we're not testing an intervention. It's a longitudinal study, which means we are going to just track and follow 100,000 women over time to just better understand what are you experiencing day to day, in your life, what are your exposures, and how that impacts cancer development and then eventually cancer progression. And so we are looking for women who are cancer-free because part of our goal is to understand why Black women get more aggressive cancer. So we have to start with a group that has no cancer at all. And we're asking you to join us. Everything can be done electronically. So once you enroll, you can confirm your eligibility. A Black woman, 25 to 55 years old, living in one of our eligible states or DC. You complete a short registration survey, which includes like your personal information, name, address, telephone number, email, and that's so we can track you over time. And all of that information goes to one group in our study management who is responsible for communicating with you. You would fill out a 1-hour survey, which is going to cover things like medical conditions, healthcare use and access, your neighborhood environment, your diet, your sleep patterns, quality of life, mental health, and then experiences of racism and discrimination. And that survey takes about 1 hour. It's divided into 3 parts, and you can start and stop it as you wish. You don't have to sit for a whole hour and take the survey. All of that information goes to the research side. And so I think the beauty of this is that that personal identifying information never gets connected to how you've responded to the questions. It's all de-identified for research purposes. And that's it. That's all it takes to be a part of the study. We are going to follow up with women twice a year, 2 short 30-minute surveys. Just to get updates. Have you had any new diagnosis of anything? Has anything changed in your life? We may ask some new things about exposures of interest. But what I tell people is it's about an hour per year investment, an hour per year with 100,000 women to really have substantial gains in understanding Black women's health, particularly around cancer.
Okay, thank you. So nothing intrusive by any means. And as you mentioned, it could all be done online. Now, the question is, I know that we've spoken about the disparity in treatments and so on, but why now? What happened? What caused this study to really come to the fore, now at this time?
I think for a long time, the American Cancer Society has had the goal to eliminate cancer for all people, which is an important goal and the mission of this organization. But it's hard to eliminate cancer for all people when you don't have data on all people. And so many of our previous studies have had large numbers of individuals in them, 1 million people, 300,000 people. But Black women have been largely underrepresented. And so we've not really been able to ask some of the deep questions that we've discussed here. We've not been able to look at intersectionality. So Black women are not a monolith. We can look at the intersection of being Black and living in the South, or race and religion, or race and all sorts of other things. And it's not until you have large numbers of people that you can really do those types of analyses justice. Obviously, I think it's been a hot topic, structural racism and social determinants of health. And so it feels like the right time to roll out a study like this. Black women are a very engaged and activated group. That we take great thought and care into ourselves, our bodies, what we're putting in our bodies. We're just very sort of in tune with those types of things. We are leaders of communities, matriarchs of our families. And so it felt like this is the right population at the right time to launch a study like this.
Thank you. And for one, I'm grateful that this study is there and it does exist, because you mentioned that the misconception is that we're hard to reach. And so it that's and I can't fathom how we're hard to reach. And also you mentioning about us not taking care of ourselves. And I don't know a Black woman that doesn't take care of herself. I don't know a single Black woman who doesn't take pride in her appearance, or when we're not feeling well, we've got an ache, a pain, or something, that we don't go to the doctor. So I'm so grateful that this study does exist. And I hope and pray that there's more studies like this to really dispel the myths that, because by saying that we're hard to reach and we don't, it's like saying that we don't care about ourselves. And that's so not true.
I think it's very easy, especially in a healthcare setting, to blame less than ideal outcomes on the person, right? You should have gone to the doctor. You should have eaten better. You should have exercised. But I think what we need is to understand all the context around that. Yeah, I should exercise, but guess what? My neighborhood doesn't have sidewalks, right? And there's heavy traffic. Traffic, which is leading to air pollution, which also can impact my odds of developing cancer, right? Like we have to think about all of these things. And I think as Black women, we do the best with what we have. And I do think that we try and take care of ourselves to the best of our ability. But this cannot just be the sole responsibility of Black women to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. Like I said very earlier, even when we do that, we still have poor outcomes. It's going to require some deeper understanding from the medical community, general community, our policymakers to really think about ways to improve health on a community level, right? We're not going to get there Black woman by Black woman saying, do better, do better, do better. That doesn't work.
And we hear that a lot, whether it's from
Yes.
relationships to our careers to our money. The Black
Yep.
always supposed to do better. But then I look at it just like, okay, do better, but with what? Where are the resources for us to be doing better?
Right, exactly.
And that's part of the frustration of things. To your point, we're doing the best we can with what we have.
Right.
And we're not really given much. So how good can we realistically do by ourselves?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Not given much and have substantial barriers that we have no control over.
Yes. Yes. There is that also, isn't there? And thank you. You mentioned ways that what the study is, but and the questionnaire, but how do women get involved to be able to get this questionnaire?
Yeah, we've tried to make it really simple. This is advantage of having a study that's designed exclusively by women and majority Black women. We've tried to be very cognizant of women's time and resources. So you simply just go to voices.cancer.org and there's a join us button. You click on that button, it'll take you straight in to see if you're eligible and then start the process.
Excellent. And I will include that link in the description for this as well. And you did mention the eligibility earlier on, but if you wouldn't mind, can you just mention it again, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So you identify as a Black woman. You're between the ages of 25 and 55, never have been diagnosed with cancer. And you live in one of the 20 eligible states or DC. And those states are on our website. You can look at it and make sure that you're in one of those states.
Excellent. Now, my question to you is, it mentions 20 eligible states and DC. Why not the whole country?
Good question. So when we were looking at the census data, we found that over 90% of Black people live within these 20 states. And so it makes it efficient for us in terms of tracking long term over 30 years to not have to track an additional 30 states, which will have less than 10% of Black people, and to only track the 20 states where we're getting the overwhelming majority of Black individuals.
Okay, that's good to know, because in my limited knowledge of US geography, you would think that, especially when you unfortunately look at the television and these very untrue things that you see, that there's a large Black populations everywhere.
Yeah, only in pockets of the country.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. And again, I'll include all of that information in the description. Now, Lauren, just before we close, because I want to thank you so much for the time that you've taken to really go into details of the statistics, the history, and the study that you're doing. Is there anything else, for example, if there's somebody that watches this and you've already reached your 100,000 women, because I'm hoping that you reach your 100,000 women like very quickly. But if there's anything else that you feel that Black women should and need to know with regards to making sure that they're getting the help that they need from their provider, and that they keep pushing, they keep seeking, if they're not happy with the treatment they're being receiving or the information they're given. What is there anything else that you could tell us?
Yeah, you know, I would just say the same thing I say to my breast cancer survivors is you have to always be your own best advocate. I tell folks, your provider knows the science. I'm a researcher. I know the science, but only you know you. You know when something's wrong. You know when something's off. And if you feel like there's something wrong or off, keep pushing until you get somebody that will listen.
Thank you. And that's one of the things I think that we tend to really second guess and doubt, because we're not medical professionals. We feel in a certain way. We're told something by our doctors, and then we just take it.
Yeah.
And then we continue to not feel well. And it's almost like this back and forth, isn't it? You go to them, they tell you this, and or they prescribe this, it's still not working. You go back to them. And sometimes, and correct me if I'm wrong, could it be that because we're not really given the help we need, we start to feel like a nuisance and then we just leave it alone.
That I've often heard that, like, I don't want to bother people. I don't want to be a burden. You know, that is often what I have heard from people, particularly in the oncology setting. But if you don't advocate for you, who will? Mm-hmm. Right. And it's important that we stand up for ourselves. It's important that we stand up for each other. And it's important that you're heard and your needs are met. And oftentimes we leave these interactions with our needs unmet. And there's still something wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And so why not push? Why not push to get the care you deserve, the communication you deserve? Because you never know when your life is on the line. You never know. I've had an experience like that myself, and it was incredibly eye-opening. And you just have to, because it could be your life.
100%. And to your point about not wanting to, people feeling like, oh, I don't want to be a nuisance. I've heard this a lot, especially with the older generation as well. It's like, oh, so I'm first generation British. And I can remember hearing a lot of the elder generations like, oh, you know, I don't want to bother the doctor. And Mike, and I'm like, that's what they're there for.
Yes, absolutely.
Because I would just say that's what they're there for. Bother the doctor. That's what they're there for. But trying to break that mentality. And I think a lot of it is because we've been made to feel like nuisances when we go with complaints, and then that whatever they prescribed hasn't helped fix that complaint. And then we go back. Because I remember I was having an issue with not keeping food down. The doctor prescribed Maalox, which I don't know if they have that over here, but the equivalent over here would be like Pepto-Bismol.
Yep.
And that's what they described. And it took for weeks of me not being able to keep food down, and eventually begrudgingly him just like, oh, okay. Turns out that I had what they diagnosed as gastric retention and my stomach wasn't working properly.
Yeah.
Like, serious?
Yeah.
You know, or going to my gynecologist and have it constantly having to go to the hospital because of my menstrual cycle. My friend says, demand a laparoscopy. It's like, oh, okay. When I went to him, demanded the laparoscopy, he's like, well, why do you want that? My response, because I'm tired of this putting me in the hospital, that's why. It turns out that I had adenomyosis.
Mm.
So, you know, but the levels that we have to go through, to your point, and I think sometimes it's exhausting and tiring that yes. We have to do so much advocacy for ourselves, and our medical professionals are not hearing us.
Right. Yeah, it is. And that's why I also think it takes a community of people, you know, your sisters, your girlfriends. I've had girlfriends say, yeah, you need to just go to the doctor, take care of that. Or you need to take a break. You seem stressed out and you can't pour from an empty cup. So you need to spend some time in you. We need to create communities for ourselves that are going to give us that support, because it is tiring. It's exhausting to constantly have to be advocating. And so when you have communities of people around you that can encourage you, that can do some advocating on your behalf, I think that's always helpful.
Wonderful. Thank you. And I think that's one of the real big takeaways from this conversation today. As tiring as it is, as exhausting as it is, advocate for yourself. And we've seemed to have gone away from that. It takes a village. We need to get back to that.
Absolutely.
It takes a village. Otherwise, we're going to be there by ourselves and probably just burn out and just give up. So, Lauren, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us and to really dig deep into this conversation. I'm going to include the links so that people can go on the website, get more information, sign up, because we want there to be a waiting list for this study. We want there to be more than 100,000 women coming up and stepping forward. And to be honest, I'm going to sign up.
Thank you.
I'm going to be one of those. I am definitely going to sign up. So thank you so much for your time and joining us here on Conversations with Alice and Jay, The Journey to Here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for spending time with us. We're already looking forward to the next episode of This is Conversations with Allison J. The journey to here. Until next time, honor, respect, and blessings to you all. If you want to connect, visit AllisonJ.net. That's AllisonJaye.net. Allison with one L, as she is the one and only.